In mind, I want to look at today in this conference some of the problems and the priorities that we need to face as priests and pastors, some principles and passions we should have, and then some prescriptions and plans. All right, so well, you hold me to it, right? All right. I'd like to just in terms of the problems and the priorities, just sort of give you some scripture passages that might help to focus that, because again, what we want to see the same problems and priorities that the Lord does. And so in his word, he gives us kind of some portraits of himself and also some instructions. So first of all, just note in Matthew 9 in verse 35, it says here, Jesus was going through all the cities and villages and teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. And he was healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. Seeing the people, he felt compassion for them, for they were distressed and dispirited, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few." Right. And you know that he asked, you know, for them to pray that the Lord would send out laborers. Well, welcome. Welcome to us, fellow laborers. We're the answer to prayers. Who, us? Yeah, us. But again, notice he's going through all the towns and villages. Now, I realize that all of us have a focused ministry in a parish. And we do have buildings and things to maintain. But again, Jesus was going through all the different towns and villages. Most of us just have boundaries, and that at least gives us some kind of a framework to work in. Now, one thought about parish boundaries, we need to think differently. You know, in the old days, and I don't know if it was ever the case out here in the Virgin Islands, but back in the States, it was pretty heavily enforced that parish boundaries told Catholics where they're supposed to go to church. And if you lived in St. Joe's boundaries, you're supposed to go to St. Joe's church, and you know, so on. All right. These days, though, boundaries tell the church where we're supposed to go. See? So in other words, if you think about it, the whole world is divided up into parishes. And parishes have boundaries. Now, in my parish in Washington, I got north to F Street, south to Pennsylvania Avenue, east to the river, west to 11th Street. That's my boundaries. And what I tried to say to the people in my parish is, I am the pastor of everyone inside those boundaries. But Father, what if they're going to the Methodist church? Still, I'm still their pastor. Well, but Father, but no, Christ only founded one church. You know, they can have their Methodist, whatever, but still somehow, I'm still their pastor. Well, what if they're an atheist? I'm still their pastor. Well, what if they're a Muslim? I'm still their pastor. See, I'm responsible for them to at least have heard of Jesus Christ. And of course, I say to them, and I can't do it alone. You're my parish. You're my family. We are collectively responsible for every man, woman, and child inside that boundary. So it's part of my job and their job as pastor and parishioners, because you know, Jesus was walking with his disciples, right? He's not just walking all alone. He's got his disciples with him. So he says he's walking through all the towns and the villages. Well, here, I'm walking through all the streets and cross streets of my parish. That's our job, to be out in the community, calling, inviting, being a presence, making sure that people know. So again, do we think in this manner as pastors? Or are we just doing the, I got to take care of the building, I got to take care of the people who come here. And do you ever get out and walk your boundaries? And I don't mean literally walk, but I mean, do you have some presence to people within your boundaries who are not, coming to church? And again, so that's kind of the first thing. The Lord is walking and he's pitying many people because they are like sheep without a shepherd. He felt compassion for them. They were distressed and they were dispirited, like sheep without a shepherd. So if we were to walk out in the streets here, then we might see some who are distressed, dispirited, some who just look bored, some who are pretty clearly locked in sinful habits or patterns. And there was a man yesterday, I was out walking in the neighborhood, and there was a man kind of walking around like this, you know, and kind of staggering around. I at one point, he almost bumped into me, and I said, you know, how are you doing? And he asked me for money, which I didn't have, so I offered to pray with him. He says, gee, thanks, you know. But I just wonder, you know, when we walk, do we ever get out like that? So just getting out and walking. But secondly, you know, again, there's other ways to reach the people who live in our neighborhood. We'll talk a little bit about that more in the latter part of this talk. But again, just note the concept. Jesus is out there. He's walking. He's not inside of a synagogue. He did do that. But he's not just inside synagogues. He's not just, if you will, you know, preaching to those who've already, you know, who know enough to come. But rather, he's out there and he's distressed. He sees people who are distressed. He has compassion for them. They're like sheep without a shepherd. They're lost. Some people out there aren't like that guy described. They're the opposite. They're rich. They're self-satisfied. They really think that, you know, they got it going on. And they have no idea that a grave's about to claim them. You fool, this very night your life will be required of you. See? Lost in wonder and awe at things that are passing away, basing their life on stuff that just doesn't matter. You know, do we care about that? And so on. Well, the Lord did, see? And if we're going to be like the Lord, how can we walk among God's people or be out in our neighborhoods or areas and say, you know, none of this matters to me. It's none of my business, see? And so, again, now part of what happens to us, I know as priests, is that we're overwhelmed, right? And so we kind of like, oh, I can't possibly, you know. And there's going to be limits. We're not God. But I wonder, just do we have the heart of Christ at least? And do we have the heart of Christ? He's walking. He's distressed. He's discouraged. Yes.
I just wanted to tell you that this morning at 7 a.m., 7:30 a.m., mm-hmm. One parishioner, he lives not too far from the church.
Yeah.
He has seen so many priests, seen so many people pass around, but he's never stopped me and spoken to me the way he did this morning.
Hmm.
Why? Because he met you maybe a block away from the church. You kind of walked with him, you came to the church. I don't know what you said to him, what you did to him, and so forth. You just say, I have a bishop talk to me here, bishop, and then pull out the cards and your card that you gave to him. But you made his day.
Oh, okay.
And so even up to this morning, you know, he's having
yeah, at the cathedral. I remember I met him the other day. Right. How about that? Yeah. Well, again, you know, it's just one of those things where I think that we're all overwhelmed, see? But again, at some level, so was the Lord, in his human nature, of course. And so I think at some level, though, even just to make contact and give people hope and, you know, all of these are just ways of saying, you know, do we get out? Do we meet people who we wouldn't ordinarily meet? And we'll look at some other ways just in getting out and walking in the neighborhood, which may not always be the most efficient use of your time, right? So we'll look at some of those reasons. But just see the heart of Christ here, okay? Now, here's another example from Jeremiah. This is God talking now, and a description of the condition of his people, and God's lamenting it. My people have become lost sheep. The shepherds have led them astray. They've made them turn aside to the mountains. And they've gone along from mountain to hill. And they've forgotten their resting place. All who come upon them have devoured them. And their adversaries have said, we are not guilty, inasmuch as they have sinned against the Lord. Who is the habitation of righteousness? Now, basically the image here is of sheep that have been scattered on a hillside. Their shepherds misled them, and now the sheep are wandered. They're up on ledges they don't know how to get down from. They're down in pits they can't get out of. See, sheep without a shepherd. The shepherd, first of all, misled them, and then the shepherds have left them now to be devoured by wolves and by any passerby because they're up on ledges they can't get. You know how sheep are. I don't know if you've seen, but sheep are not very smart. And they don't quite know how to get down from things when they're up, you know, they really need. So that's us, by the way. We're compared to sheep, right? All right. But now, again, I'm not saying we've all misled our people, but we all know priests who have misled. We have known Protestant ministers. We've known people who have really seriously misled God's people. And the question is, do we have a heart for that? God is very concerned for the condition of his people. He's saying, it's a mess down there, and my shepherds, so even my own shepherds have misled a lot of them. And now my sheep are scattered in every hillside and place and village and so on. And then he rebukes the shepherds further in Ezekiel, God says, in Ezekiel 34. He says to the shepherds, you eat the fat and you clothe yourselves with the wool. And you slaughter the fat sheep without feeding the flock. And those who are sickly you have not strengthened. The diseased you have not healed. The broken you have not bound up. The scattered you have not brought back. Nor have you sought for the lost. But with force and with severity you have dominated them. They were scattered for lack of a shepherd. And they became like food for every beast of the field. And they were scattered. My shepherds did not search for my flock. They only cared for themselves. And they cared for themselves rather than for my flock. Okay. So again, we've heard these rebukes before. And every year or so, in the breviary, we have to endure some of these as we read them. Now again, this is not my place to say that all of us have utterly failed. But we all have some areas where we know we may have fallen short. And it's just a chance for us to say, well, Lord, help me then. Help me. Help me to get my priorities right. Help me to understand that I've really got to take care of these people. I can't just say, oh, well, I'm overwhelmed. I don't have time. I really do have to have, and even if I can't do it today, what are my plans? Do I have some folks in the parish who can help me? Are there ways I can reach some people that I'm not reaching? I can't do it alone, and I'm not supposed to do it alone. So, Lord, show me. Show me, Lord. Help me to know what I need to do. And it's not even about growing my flock. I'd like to have more people in the pews, Lord, but please help me, Lord. I know that somehow I'm supposed to reach them. And I want to do it effectively. But show me how. Show me how. And so sometimes we have to just go before the Lord with an empty heart and say, I don't know the solution. I don't know. Let me just tell you one experience that I had in pastoral ministry to show you how this kind of prayer can work. And I'll give you some other examples later on. But I had just moved into St. Thomas More Parish, which in Washington, D.C., is at the very tip of the diamond, the very lowest part of the city, and it's low in different ways too. Very, very poor neighborhood, all surrounded by projects. Very, very difficult, painful neighborhood. And no sooner had I moved in, within 6 months, than a woman was murdered right in front of the rectory. Right, we have a little driveway, and then we had a vacant lot on the other side of that driveway, and the rectory is over here. So as far as I am from you to just maybe those set of tables over there, a woman named Deborah Irax was stabbed to death. Now, poor Deborah, we all knew her. She was a regular in the neighborhood. She had a drug problem, and she would ask for money and things. But there was something about Deborah we all kind of liked. She would stand out at the local stoplight and kind of ask for money, and people would throw her some coins. But anyway, so one day she apparently ran into some guy, and they never actually caught who it was, but she was stabbed to death right there, just 100 yards from the front door of the rectory, less than 100 yards. So the police came, and of course the body was taken away. All the crime scene tape was taken down. But that night I'm in the chapel praying, and I said, Lord, I don't know what happened, but I want to pray for this poor woman. And I heard the Lord say to me, if you and this congregation don't do anything to change this neighborhood, then her blood is on your hands too. Look, Lord, I just moved in. I hardly know the neighborhood yet. Okay, I've got all the excuses, right? So I said, okay. So all I knew to do is I said, okay. So I went to the congregation that Sunday. She was stabbed to death on a Friday. So by Sunday, I was in the pulpit. And I said, look, I said, my people, here's what happened. And they were shocked. And I don't know what to do. But I do know this, that the Lord told me that if we don't do something to make this neighborhood better, then her blood is on our hands. So I'm your pastor. I don't have an answer right now what we're supposed to do. But I do know this. I'm asking you to pray for me. Pray for an anointing. And let's really pray. So within a few days, Tuesday, Wednesday, the phone rings. There's a guy who I became very good friends with, Tillman, who later became Deacon Tim Tillman is his name. But he wasn't a deacon then. But he was calling from the Washington Interfaith Network, which was I've decided to call you today because I wanted to know if you'd like to find out ways to make your neighborhood a better place. I said, and I knew a little bit about the Washington Interfaith Network already. I had done some organizing work in a previous assignment, but I said, gee, you know, you sound like an answer to prayer. Well, come right over. So within the next couple days, he and I started walking the neighborhood. We started dreaming. And we started doing something called organizing, where we started bringing neighbors to the table, asking their concerns, talking with them, meeting with them. And we started doing little projects here and there, which began to... The main idea was to get neighbors meeting together and talking again and stop living behind locked doors. And little by little, people came out to the church hall. I got some new church members coming to the sacraments that way, but we also just got our neighbors. We started to meet with the local police. One of the first things you pick little things first to solve. So we had a speeding problem coming down 4th Street, which was a big downhill thing, and people just kept going faster and faster. So we had them put in a series of speed bumps and stop signs, and that helped come because we'd had 3 children killed there on that street in the last 4 or 5 years. So kids were getting hit by speeding cars. So that was one quick thing we did. But then we said, now what about the field where Deborah was killed, which really got the conversation started. And we all had a dream that we wanted to see a youth recreation center built there that would try to get youth off the street, because it was discovered that a young man who was in his late teens stabbed her, and later on, and he admitted to it, and was already in prison for something else. And so we thought, well, maybe we can rescue some of these young men and women from the streets and give them better options and do mentoring and tutoring and even sports and entrepreneurial things and have a computer lab. And so we dreamed, and we dreamed big. And but sure enough, we got the resources together, raised $5.5 million. We got the Christ Child Society to give us $1 million. I went down and met with the mayor. He gave us $2 million. He needed a political victory. He was ready to give us the $2 million from community development block grant money. And so we got $3 million on the table. We went and we got the rest, another $1.5 million, through individual smaller donations, and we built it. Took us 5 years from start to finish, but we built it. And so where that woman's blood soaked into the soil and cried out to heaven for vengeance, that cry reached the ears of not just me, but my parishioners and then other pastors in the local neighborhood. Several churches came together, community, the mayor, the city, we all came together. And to this day now, there is exactly what I described to you, a beautiful building there with a computer lab and 3 other classrooms for tutoring and other things, and then a large sports area with a stage for all kinds of different things. And it's a youth rec center, and it's owned by the church, but it's run for all the children in the neighborhood. So, and that kind of apostolate goes. Now, that's, of course, addressing one need, and it's largely a kind of a need of this world. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff, you know, when you begin to walk out in a neighborhood and you're grieved at what you see, and you just want to try to make a difference. And we had the land, so we were able to bring that to the table. The city brought some money, and some other, you know, people brought money, and it was done. And those are the kinds of things that, again, they come from a heart that's, like the Lord says here, that's grieved, that he sees a flock that's been lost. And somewhere the Lord, that cry from Ezekiel reached my desk. And the Lord says, you know, this is what's going on. My people are lost, and I need my shepherds to start shepherding. See? Did I do a perfect thing, and am I patting myself on the back? No, I'm just telling you what the Lord can do and what's on the Lord's mind and what's on the Lord's heart. And when we can, when possible, I'm not saying we can all respond that way all the time to everything that comes up. There's only so many $5 million buildings you can put up, right? But those are the kinds of things that can happen when the Lord's words actually reach our heart and the heart of our people. That's what can happen, because God's word is effective. It's living and active. Now, again, then, there is then this recommissioning that... So we've seen that the Lord walks about and he sees ruins. And the reasons for it, in some cases, the shepherds have misled the sheep. But certainly the other reason is the sheep have been scattered for all sorts of reasons. And, again, there are some rebukes for the shepherds on that account. The shepherds do have to render an account when the sheep are that lost. And I have to say, I do take a little of this to heart, and I hope you do too, although we can't all take personal responsibility for everything. We have to at least say this much, that we have gone in the Archdiocese of Washington from 35% to 40% of people going to Mass on Sunday when I was first ordained, down to 20% to 25%, and that's happened on my watch. I am one of the priests. I'm one of the leaders among the priests of the Archdiocese of Washington. I've been on the College of Consultors. I'm a dean. I've been on the priest council and all that stuff. I'm in all the big poobah stuff. And it's happened on my watch. And I can't just say, well, ain't it awful? I mean, again, the question is, you know, while we sit around and talk about, well, what are we going to do to get the Cardinal's appeal up next year? Souls are walking away from the church. Souls aren't getting to church. People are getting lost. People are getting locked in sin. And so often we're just doing business as usual. And so at some point, I can't just finally say, well, those priests before me handed me a lousy situation. You know, I can't do that anymore. I'm 25 years ordained. Now, I'm not saying I'm completely personally responsible for everything, but I want to say I can't walk and say, well, everything's fine. And it isn't. And part of the reason it isn't because of me. And if that is, would you please show me, Lord, so that I can try to do better without becoming overwhelmed? Okay. Then, so here's the Lord then kind of recommissions his own apostles, you see. So here we are in Mark chapter 6 now. Jesus landed, he saw a large crowd, and he had compassion on them. Do you see that again? Every time he sees these crowds, he has compassion. Now, he didn't trust them. He challenged them. He didn't just pat them on the hand and say, oh, you poor people, here, let me feed you. He would challenge them. He'd tell them to carry a cross. He'd warn them about judgment. He'd tell them parables and tell them to snap too. So he's not just out there saying, oh, these poor people. In that sense, he's not pitying them. He's having compassion, though, see? So he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Largely, they're living without guidance. You know how often did the Lord have to rebuke the religious leaders of his day? You know, people who are well don't need a doctor. See, I've come to call I've come to call those who are sick. And in a way, he's saying to them, why aren't you out there? Why are you sitting in the synagogues? You're down in Jerusalem debating all kinds of tidbits of the law, and meanwhile you look down on all these people as the unobservant, the great unwashed, the unobservant. They don't keep the law, this sinner. And the Lord is saying, well, and what are you going to do about it? That's kind of what he's saying, right? But anyway, here we are. So the Lord landed, he saw a large crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And again, how can that be with all these synagogues, with the big city of Jerusalem nearby, a big university town, all these scribes and scholars of the law running around in their phylacteries and praying? How is it that they're with like sheep without a shepherd? See? Okay. So the Lord began to teach them many things. Imagine teaching people. Eureka! By this time, it was late in the day, and his disciples came to him. And they said, this is a remote place, and it's already very late. So send them away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and buy themselves something to eat. So he knows what these guys are up to, right? He said, all right. He says here, but he answered, you give them something to eat. Put that in your overwhelmed file, okay? You give them something to eat. And of course, they say, hey, wait, we're overwhelmed, Lord. Look, as they say here, Lord, that would take more than a year and a half worth of wages, or half a year's worth of wages. Are we supposed to go and spend that much on bread and give them something to eat? Now, here comes a question. Remember, when he asked this question, you're supposed to answer it. Don't wait for the apostles to answer it. Here comes the question now. Pay attention, my brothers. How many loaves do you have? No, I should just end the conference and we'll pray now. Okay. How many loaves do you have? See? Lord, I'm overwhelmed. It's too big. You give them something to eat. Lord, I can't. It's too much. How many loaves do you have? And of course, that's the kind of a thing that you need to pray about. I could fill in lots of possible answers for you right now. But would you maybe mark down, if you're taking notes here, write that question down. Take it home with you. How many loaves do you have? Which is maybe another way, maybe you could recast the question. What gifts do you have? What resources do you have? Some of you have good physical health, some not. Some of you are younger, some of you are older. So your gifts might vary, and what you can do will vary based on your state in life. Some of you are very talented in certain areas and not in others. Some of you are wonderful at organizing people. And maybe the loaves you do have are good folks you can help you and say, let's get together and let's start walking this community, or let's go over and pray with people at the local market this morning, or maybe that's your gift. Maybe your gift is more to teach, and you're saying, all right, so let me set up some way I can, you know, teach. Let's send out some flyers. Let's invite some folks who don't usually come. Let's talk about some topics that people are angry about in the church today, you know? One of the things I did, and you'll see these on the when I talk about some of the things I've done in the past, but I set up and I sent out flyers in the neighborhood. I called it the Catholic Controversies Course. You got a problem with Catholic Church's teachings? Come and ask a man who'll give you an answer, you know? And so I set it up that way. And, you know, sure enough, I got some neighbors. I got some of the usual suspects, my own parishioners, you know? But I also got some new faces, and we started going through it. People were saying, well, and I'm not going to say I've got a bumper crop of new parishioners, but again, we're beginning to make those connections. You see the idea? So, but I mean, what loaves, what bread do you have? What are your gifts? Maybe you're a man of deep prayer. You know, there was an older priest I knew who he had very little strength left. He couldn't walk very well and all of this, but one thing he knew how to do was pray. And so he said, I tell you what, would you allow me to just sit in the church for 4 hours a day and keep the church door open, and I'll put a sign out, come and pray with Father. And people started coming in, and people were praying with him. He was leading rosaries, just sitting quietly, and the word started to get out, and he had a prayer ministry going. There wasn't much left for him to do. He had very little strength. His hearing was poor. His mind wasn't clear enough that he could give long teaching. He didn't have that kind of stamina anymore. But he could sit there in the front pew and pray and put out a sign and say, come in and pray with Father. Why not? They went on in and they started to pray. Word gets out. Another old priest I knew had very little energy left. He said, but I can't hear confessions. I can. His hearing was still good enough. And so once again, and it wasn't in my parish, it was in another parish, but he just put out the sign. He just said, confessions from 12 to 4. Every day he was in that confessional for 4 hours a day. And at first, very few people. Suddenly, 2, 3, 4, suddenly 50, 60, 70 people coming in an afternoon. And so much so that another priest had to be asked to pitch in every now and again. Huh? See? So what loaves do you have? Okay? All right. One of my, I'm the dean, and I did the same thing in one of our local parishes. The youth group in that parish are people in their 70s. That's their youth group. I mean, it's a real octogenarian place. I don't know what happened to that parish, but over the years they just got a senior citizen signature, and they're just old folks now. But again, what they did, and I encouraged them as the dean, because their pastor didn't have this idea, but I said, well, Father, I said, how about this idea? I'll get some folks in my parish, and we'll put flyers on the doors of your parish boundaries, and just saying, call our prayer line. We have people, old folks, I didn't say old folks, but that are going to be praying every day from 12 to 2 in the church, and they want to pray for your intentions. So you can, you know, mail it in, you can call it in, or here's the email, you know, send it in, but we want to know what your prayer intentions are, and we will pray for you. We promise you, every day from 12 to 2 on these, you know, days of the week, there's going to be someone in St. Benedict the Moor Church, and they're going to be praying. And again, that was their way of doing outreach. They're just too old to knock on doors and get out in a safe way and pray with people, but they're doing that outreach. They're reaching, see? The loaves that Father had were old stale loaves, but they were still loaves, and they were ready to pray. And they wanted to make a difference in people's lives, you know? So, again, what loaves do you have is the question the Lord asks. So, maybe just a few, we've looked at some of the problems and priorities. So, here would come the second part, just some principles and some passions. And I've pretty much introduced them. So, again, brothers, what is our main responsibility, okay, as pastors of souls? And again, remember, not just our parishioners now, but our parish boundary, our parish considered in toto. All right? What is our main responsibility? And again, you might say, well, to teach, to govern, and to sanctify. Okay. But maybe more in a phrase, give them something to eat yourself. See? Are you overwhelmed? Again, but what loaves do you have? Okay. In other words, the Lord said, all right, I'm not asking you to go find a half year's worth of wages to go buy bread for all of them. But I think I'm asking what you do have. Give them something to eat yourself. All right. And then, of course, you know the rest of that story. The Lord takes and he multiplies it and he does incredible things. You take one step, God takes two. You know, trust God in this. This is really his work. It's his people. It's his kingdom. He's let it fall into this disrepair. I'm just kidding. But, you know, you get the idea. But he does want us. He who made us without us will not save us without us, right? The famous Augustine great quote. You know, God who made you without you will not save you without you. He wants us to bring the loaves and the fishes we do have, meager though they may seem, inadequate though they may scream, we nevertheless bring them to the Lord. And he is the one who can take and multiply them. Okay, so again, what is our main responsibility? Give them something to eat. Shepherd them, yes. Teach them, govern them, sanctify them by all these means, sacraments, the word of God, calling them, preaching to them, shouting, ringing the church bell, doing something to say, God is still calling, my friend. God is still calling. See? Okay. Now, then the question for you is, and me, are you doing maintenance work or are you doing missionary work? Now, we got to do both. But you know what most of us do is too much maintenance, not enough missionary. So, and again, we've got these burdensome buildings, and beautiful but burdensome, right? They take a lot of time, and we've got personnel, and we've got, sometimes you've got a school, you've got all kinds of internally focused things, right? So the question, though, is even in spite of all that, how much maintenance stuff, in other words, maintaining what you've already got, meeting with parishioners you already have, sitting down with people who've been coming to church for years, that's maintenance. I don't just mean maintenance on buildings, but I mean maintenance in terms of just maintaining what is, all right? How much maintenance mode are you in and how much missionary mode? What are you doing to try to reach new souls, to reach people who haven't heard the gospel or haven't heard it effectively or have seemingly rejected it, but maybe we'll hear there'll be a moment for them, you see? What are you doing? What am I doing to reach new ears? New souls, and so on. So that's what we mean by the missionary versus the maintenance mode, all right? And then there's another kind of related terminology that you probably heard before. Are you doing clubhouse stuff or lighthouse stuff, all right? Clubhouse or lighthouse, you know? Parishes can come to seem to people like a clubhouse, you know? So what is the purpose of a parish? The purpose of the parish is for me to have my spaghetti dinner every year. Father, that's why this parish exists. The Sodality every year has this fundraiser, and it's our spaghetti dinner, and by gosh, that's why this parish exists. And people think like that, and we let them think like that. This is our place. This place exists so that I can have the baby shower. So you have this beautiful hall, Father Neil, because people want to have parties. That's why you have this hall. See, and that's, but people fall into that, right? That's, and we can fall into that too, right? And so, again, the question for us is, are we running clubhouses or are we running a lighthouse? A clubhouse is taking care of its members. A lighthouse is calling out. It's warning of danger. It is calling to people at a distance, saying, look out, be careful, come, go this way. You see, that's what lighthouses do. So the question is, is your parish, is my parish, more clubhouse or lighthouse? And again, both are important. I'm not saying get rid of the clubhouse stuff. I'm saying we need to take care of our people, and it's important for them to have fellowship, and it's important for them, you know, to have these opportunities. But sometimes it takes so much energy, so much time. I don't know about you all, but most pastors I know secretly wish that their social hall would just burn down. Right? Because there's fights over who gets to use it and how much it's going to cost and why should I have to pay? I've been a member. And then you have insurance. In Washington, anyway, there's all these insurance things now. And if they want to have liquor, they have to get a liquor license. And they're blaming you for all this. I say, hey, talk to those guys up at that White House at the end of the street called the U.S. Capitol. Go talk to those boys. They're the ones who have passed all these laws. But at the end of the day, you got to insure it. There's liquor licenses. There's people in the neighborhood complain about the noise. And meanwhile, you're trying to run a church and get people to live the gospel, and all they care about is, how come I have to pay extra for maintenance? I said, we'll clean up, Father. Well, we promise we'll clean up. We promise. Will you scrub the toilets? Oh, Father, no. Well, then, don't tell me you're going to clean up. You know? They never mean they're going to scrub the toilets when they say they swear they'll clean up, because they have a guy in their family who's really good at that, Father. So, you know, you get what I'm saying. It's just insanity that you end up with. So they secretly wish that the social hall would burn down. No, not this one, Father. But anyway, you see the idea. But okay. But again, it's not just pastors that struggle with this mentality, right? It's clubhouse lighthouse. And so if you start to do lighthouse stuff as a pastor, there's going to be some of the incumbents. Well, who are some of those people that Father's inviting in here? Look at that person. grab your purse, you know. Or in my neighborhood, we're having a lot of racial change. So we've gone from being a predominantly black neighborhood to being a predominantly white neighborhood. So I try to invite our new neighbors. My father's trying to turn this into a white church. See? Have I been with you all this time? You know, but I have to accept the fact that I've been white all my life, and there's always going to be that, you know, but I get that. But you see what I'm saying? People sometimes resist us, even when we want to try to do Lighthouse stuff. They're saying, who are you bringing in here? I don't like these new people. Or sometimes it's an age thing. So you get some new young people to come, and you know how sometimes the Murphy family has always done the spaghetti dinner, but the Murphy family, the youngest one, is like 70. Who will take over the spaghetti dinner? Oh. But they don't want to work with young people because, well, you know how young people are. They're not dependable, Father. You know, and so you see what I'm saying? There's a lot of resistance when you try to get new leaders, or you try to reach new faces, or you start to forge new directions, or there's going to be resistance. And a lot of us too easily cave on that, you see. And so we got to teach around these things a lot, you know, Lighthouse versus Clubhouse stuff. All right. So again, and again, more personal, just two real personal questions for us, Fathers, which just, again, we've been asking them already. Do you love God's people? And not just the ones who are in your pews, but when you walk out here. And again, this is your parish, Father, I mean anyone's parish, you know. Do you love the people when you go to the market? Do you have concern for them? You ever think, I wonder where their soul is? Do they know God? You know, have they met the Lord? Where are they going to spend eternity? You know, I realize we got our head will explode if we're, you know, we have to have some boundaries. I get that. But somewhere, that open heart that just hopes and prays that people you're meeting know the Lord somehow. And at least within your own boundaries and within some degree of affinity around your parish, you're reaching souls, you see. Right next to me, literally, 20 feet out the window is a row house, you know? And they don't go to church. They're Catholics. They don't go to church. So I went, knocked on their door, talked to them a little bit. They still haven't come to Mass, but I'm working with them. You know? But I care. I mean, step one is to care. It bothers me that two Catholics are literally 20 feet away from my window to their window, and they're not coming to Mass. They're in mortal sin, at least objectively speaking. They're in mortal sin. And they're not being fed. And I know I can't badger them and beat the door down and drag them to church. I know that they're free, but they know that I care, and they know the door is open. And every now and again, I still continue to ask. I strike up the conversation, you know. Whereas, you know, too many of us are like, oh, I don't want to trouble the neighbors, you know. So, again, some thoughts. Where's your heart? Do we love them? And then the other question is, you know, do we have a passion to save souls? See, I don't just mean we all say yes, I want to save souls. I mean, that's sort of theoretical, but I mean, do we have a passion for it? A passion that's enough to get us to move out the door and get out of our comfort zone a little bit and mix it up with people and be willing to get a little embarrassed when they ask us questions that we don't want to answer. Like, well, tell me more about that abuse scandal in the church. You know, oh, God, here we go again. You know, and you're going to get some of that, and it's going to be grieving. You know, and wearying. But do we have enough of a passion to overcome the inertia of just sitting at the rectory and saying, well, all I can do is return phone calls today? Okay. All right. One other personal story about maintenance versus a mission. At Christmas time, we give out Christmas baskets. And most of you probably have the same experience here, I would imagine. I used to be under the illusion that the poor all went to church. They don't. In fact, most of the poor don't go to church, at least in where I live. And so they all sign up for Thanksgiving and Christmas baskets. Every year, they're all lined up. We got about like 150 Christmas, or whatever, with turkey and everything. And we're feeding their stomachs, but not their souls. And so I keep saying to myself, well, it's a good thing the corporal works of mercy are a good thing. But by gosh, we got to do the spiritual works. Well, anyway, so what happened was, though, this year, the day we gave out Christmas baskets, the Sodality wanted to have their big Christmas dinner. And Father, of course, will be coming, will he not? And I made a bad decision. I'm just going to tell you right now, I made a bad decision. I said, well, I know the Sodality's been angry with me about a lot of things lately. You know, not really angry, but they've been a little bit miffed that I missed a couple of their big events, Father. So I said, oh, I better go. You know, Father's where I should have been. I should have been meeting those poor families that came to pick up their Christmas basket and offering to pray with them and asking them if they have a church home and saying, and asking them to be very serious about keeping the commandment to keep holy the Sabbath. That's where I should have been, really. Because I went and I sat with some women who, you know, they've been with the church for years and are doing great work, but I could have other opportunities to meet with them. Again, it's a judgment call. And I just think I made a bad one. I sat down with 25 older ladies who, thanks be to God, have been very faithful. They're wonderful women. But I missed the opportunity to meet about 150 neighbors, mostly poor, who, for the most part, have no church home and are living lives that are, they're like sheep without a shepherd. So that's the kind of decisions we have to make, you know, as priests, you know. And again, there is a place for maintenance, don't get me wrong. There's a time for me to sit down with the sodality and say, I appreciate what you're doing, you've been wonderful. But I really feel like I missed an opportunity, you know, and those are the kinds of things that all of us have to struggle with. So those are some kind of focal stories. Now, some prescriptions, let me just tell you a few little things we've done, and then I know you all have some ideas too, and so I want to kind of say a few things that I've tried, and then, you know, maybe that'll spark some thoughts of things that you've either thought about trying or have tried and you found helpful or not found helpful and so on. So let's share a little bit with of our own experiences. But first of all, let's look at some internal parish matters as well as some outreach matters, so kind of combining both of them together. But internally, a huge, huge, huge problem for those who are still coming to Mass is still this problem of confession, right? And getting them to go to confession regularly, and it's kind of discouraging. You try to get there and you have confession and two or three people come. And so what happens is, well, you start getting there late, and they start saying, well, Father wasn't there when I got there, and so they're discouraged and you're discouraged, and it all starts to kind of flag. Now, again, I don't guess I need to tell you, but the Saturday afternoon confession, which was traditional, at least back in the States, isn't really something that works anymore. So one of the things we started doing in most of our parishes is that priests try to hear confessions before each scheduled Mass on the weekend. Now, that's not always easy. Like, I'm trying to do Sunday school and get back up in time for about 15 minutes before Mass to hear some confessions and so on. What I'm going to try this Lent, though, just for Lent, see how it goes, is hearing confessions after Mass. I know the model's all wrong. I get that. But I can't tell you how many people say, I couldn't get there on time, Father, before the Mass. For whatever reason, people have a hard time getting to Mass on time. And so I'm just going to head to the box during Lent. I'm going to just do it as an experiment. I say, folks, I'm really worried about you all. You're not getting to confession. They've heard me preach on it a lot. I said, you know, I always kid with them. I say, boy, you all are so holy. You know, it's just, wow, it's amazing to me how holy you are. I mean, I go to confession once a week, and some of you never need to go to confession. It's like, wow, you're so holy. I mean, they can play, well, Father, you know. But, you know, you're kind of getting the point across with a little bit of humor. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's astonishing how many people haven't been to confession, like, ever, forever. And again, we got to have a heart about that, because the Lord gave the sacrament for a purpose. And secondly, some people are in pretty serious sin, and they're still going to confession. I mean, to communion, and they're committing kind of a, at least objectively speaking, sacrilege and bringing condemnation. And it's just not a good thing. And we got to be urgent with our people. Say, you know, you've really got to get to confession. But part of being urgent is setting the time aside. So I'm going to go to them this, because I've been preaching now for about the last 6 months, because confession really fell off in the last year. I don't know why. I mean, you know, it usually works. You preach for a while, and then they start coming, and then they fall off again. So, all right. So I'm announcing a plan that in Washington, we always have the Wednesday evenings. The light is on for you. And every church in the Archdiocese on Wednesday from 6 to 7:30 is open for confession. So anywhere in the Archdiocese. That's a diocesan program, but on top of that, I'm going to say, I am going not to greet you at the end of Mass. I'm going to the confessional after every Mass, and I'm going to wait there. And some of you need to get. And don't give me the excuse that you got here late or whatever. I'm serious about this. I really want you to go to confession, okay? So those are the ways we, you know, say that. So that's something I'm going to be doing. I want to also say that, you know, you got to bring a lot of reading material with you because there's going to just be some downtime when you're in the confessional these days. And so, but, you know, whatever you decide to do, just go there and be there and hang in there. And sometimes it takes a while for people to know you're really serious. Like I gave you that example of the priest who was older, he couldn't do much, but he could hear confessions. And people said, well, you're crazy. No one's going to come from 12 to 4 or, you know, to have their confession heard. Well, they were wrong. People found out about it. The word started to get out. And as I said, but it got so heavy, the traffic, that they had to bring a second priest in finally. And when the word really gets out that we're really serious and we really care and we're actually going to be there, people start to hear and they start to spread the word. But it takes time. It's like anything. If you try one Sunday, oh, it didn't work very well, and you try a second, well, it still didn't work, and you give up too quick. You know, this is one of those things that just takes a little time, you know. So I would encourage you to be, this is one of the most, I think, significant internal matters to those who are already coming in that on that maintenance side. Confession is so critical. What a marvelous thing you've got people in adoration down there right now. And so I think we've done a lot to sort of reinculcate some Eucharistic adoration and Eucharistic devotion. I think we'd really fallen, that had fallen away. We were laughing a little, laughing ironically at lunch about, in the what were we thinking file when we kicked the tabernacle off to the side, you know, and now the tabernacles have been moved back for the most part. But we're getting our mojo back, I think, with Eucharistic devotion and so on. And thanks be to God. But we need to do a lot more work, I think, with consistently working on confession. And as I said, maybe like I said in the conference yesterday, maybe it was helping people to maybe go a little deeper and find confession a little bit more fruitful in their lives. It could be something else we can do as well. Now, regarding outreach, let me just tell you quickly about a program that I did. One of the things when you do, one possibility, and not all your neighborhoods are set up like this, mine is, so I'll just tell you our experience, and you take what you like and leave the rest. But I live in a neighborhood of row houses, so we've got a lot of people living very closely together. You know, the separation from doors is, you know, 25 feet. So, you know, you're going, and it makes a lot of sense to do door to door. So I decided that we had too many people in our neighborhood. My church has turned into a commuter church. 80% of the people that come to my masses on Sunday live out in Maryland. They commute in from 20, 25 miles away because we have a dynamic liturgy, decent preaching, magnificent choir music, and so on, and people come from all over the area. And that works, but that number still has been eroding. You know, it's getting older and smaller. And meanwhile, I've got a neighborhood that's filled up with young white professionals, most of them working down on the hill, and our parish wasn't reaching them. And so we decided to do a door-to-door for two reasons. We wanted to do straight evangelization, but also just let them know we're here. And you would be surprised how many didn't even know we were a Catholic church. So our immediate feedback was signage, put a Blessed Mother statue out there. We're doing everything we can to make sure people know this is the Catholic church, see? And so that was one thing. But again, we started doing the door-to-door. But here's what you got to do, I think, when you do a door-to-door campaign or any kind of an outreach to the neighborhood. You want the whole parish involved. Not everybody can walk. Not everybody can knock on doors. Not everybody has the personality. But even those who do sometimes are too old. But you still want to involve the whole parish. So we broke into three different categories. Actually, four. Four categories. I wanted the whole parish involved in this door-to-door campaign. We had the walkers. We had the prayers. We had the cookers. And pardon the expression, we had the hookers. Now, the walkers, that's pretty obvious. They were trained, and we spent over a year training for this. We didn't just send them out. We spent a year training. We did role-playing. We read biblical passages about what to take with you on the journey, what not, and how to endure persecution. We went through all those biblical texts. We studied. We prayed. We did role-playing. And finally, after about a year worth of training, we're ready to go start knocking on doors. I had 40 people to sign up to march and go out in teams. We sent them out in teams of three, sometimes two, but usually three. We had our religious sisters. I got 20 sisters in the convent from an order of sisters that lives in our diocese, and a lot of them agreed to go with us. So I went. We all started. We went. We formed teams. We just picked starts the neighborhood. We just started knocking on doors, and we left stuff when they weren't there. But we started meeting our neighbors. Now, while we were doing that, got the prayers back in church. 40 more people who were praying, doing a holy hour in front of the Blessed Sacrament. praying for us. And then I got 40 more people, and they weren't all in the kitchen at the same time, but cooking a meal. So when we returned, we had a meal, we debriefed, and we had a nice meal. And we went out. We didn't go every Saturday, because if you do something every year, people get worn out. So we did 6 Saturdays in a row, and then we took a break. So we did it in the fall for 6 Saturdays, took a break, and we did 4 Saturdays in the spring. Okay? And every Saturday, these teams would go out for just an hour to an hour and 15, hit a certain number. We gave them the addresses with clipboards, and they went out, started knocking on doors, leaving material, meeting with people, talking, and getting the feedback. We would gather. And meanwhile, we had this group called the Hookers. Now, the Hookers were those who were setting up events. Not everyone's ready to come and sit in a church pew. So what we were able to do when we would go out and meet with our neighbors and say, look, we got a lot of stuff going on in the parish, and not all of it's, religious stuff. So we got like the army band coming. We had concerts lined up in the church. We had movie night. We had different... just different outreaches. We had the mayor coming to visit one day, and so on. So all of these were just opportunities where I'm not ready to come to your mass, but I might come for that concert you mentioned. The army band, you say they're going to play some Christmas carols. Okay, great. And so the army band comes. Now we've got 300 people in the church that I've never met before for the army band concert, and I'm there with my collar on, with this magnificently beautiful church that's shouting about. And they're up there looking like this and seeing, and I'm explaining to them. We got the material to subtly hand out. We're not directly proselytizing, but I've got my evangelization teams in place. They go and they greet people. They welcome them. You know, the first step in friendship evangelization is friendship. Just become friendly with your neighbors. Open the church doors. Have concerts. Have means that people can come in and meet and greet, and sometimes open up a church hall for a civic function. So we had the mayor come for one of her meetings recently, and we had about 80 people that came and met in our church. And once again, I was there. Other members of the community meet to meet, and so on. You see the idea I'm getting at here, right? Now, but what I want to emphasize is that if you're going to do an evangelization, don't leave it to a committee. Make it a whole parish activity. You need people praying. You need people preparing maybe a meal for those who do the work. You need other people preparing activities and with an evangelical thought in mind. We are going to have a movie night where we're going to try to invite some of our neighbors, or we're going to do different things, that will, a concert that might attract people who might not be ready to come to a mass, but they will come to a concert, and so on. You see the idea? And I'm going to have a team in place who can greet them, welcome them, get to know them, hand information, answer questions about the church. See the idea? Okay. So that's a practice that we did as far as that. Now, again, another internal matter now. We started inside, we're going outside. Here's another inside matter. Catechetics, terrible problem today. How are we going to teach people the faith? Well, again, the big problem. You can teach the kids till you're blue in the face, and their parents don't know a thing. Their parents haven't been catechized, right? So we're doing now something called whole family catechesis. Now, whole family catechesis means you bring the whole family in for catechism. We have Sunday school on Sunday. Between the two main masses, we have Sunday school. Remember, I'm a commuter church, so you got to get them while they're there. So, but that means, though, of course, in order to do that, I have to have everyone on the same curriculum. What I do is I have the parents in the cafeteria, and I'm teaching them what their kids are learning up in the classrooms. So I got 60, 70 kids up in the classrooms, but I got their parents down in the cafeteria, and the kids are learning. We're going through maybe the story of Adam and Eve right now up there in the classroom. So I'm downstairs teaching on original sin, teaching on Adam and Eve, teaching how we got into the mess we're in, all right? And then maybe right now, actually, we're going through the module on the sacraments. So right now, all those kids at every grade level are learning the 7 sacraments up in the classrooms. And I'm down in the cafeteria teaching the parents the 7 sacraments and trying to give them materials to teach their children, but especially this. This is one of the things I've learned. Parents don't read their kids' Bible stories anymore. So I'm teaching the parents. For example, we studied confirmation last Sunday just before I came here. I read the story of David and Goliath. I said, this is a great story about courage. This is a great story about not getting the memo that you're nothing, you're not up to it. This is about getting out, witnessing, saying the God of Israel can overcome whatever giant that I'm facing. This is a story you ought to tell your kids about courage, because one of the great seven, you know, the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit is fortitude or courage, right? So I read it to them and I say, now go home and read this story to your children. So I'm not just trying to say, confirmation is a sacrament, blah, 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 blah. I'm not trying to just do head stuff with them. I'm trying to buy stories and connect them to the Bible. And you know, stories, my brothers, are wonderful. People remember stories long after they forget all the details of something in the catechism. They remember the stories. And I say, now, when we talk about confirmation, one of the great strengths of confirmation is cowardly, fearful men and women were locked in a room like this. Fearful. And the Holy Spirit came, and all their fear went away, and they opened the door, and they went out, and they conquered overwhelmingly. And yes, a lot of them also died for it. But they went out with courage, see? And tell the story of David and Goliath, or tell the story of the upper room. Read these stories to your children, see? And that's the kind of stuff I'm doing with them. It's called whole family catechesis. You're not just instructing the parents, you're trying to help the parents learn how to teach. So you're giving them some materials and so on. Does that make sense? Now again, obviously, it works better in a smaller parish like mine has become, where I have 70 maybe kids, maybe 80 in the program. But I'm able to put them all on the same curriculum and kind of work. It's called a spiral curriculum, and we always come back around to the same basic topics every year, but we do it at an age-appropriate level for the kids, and then I teach the parents. Okay, so that's an example of what we call whole family catechesis. Now, again, I would also encourage you, if you're not already doing it, you know, people love Bible studies, especially because of the influence of Protestantism, you know. So we knew that our Protestant churches all around us were having Wednesday night Bible studies. Well, guess what? I'm doing a Wednesday night Bible study. I can beat any one of those guys at their own game. It's not just about competition, but you know what I'm saying. The point is that why should my people who want to be instructed in the Bible be going over to Minister Jim's parish? I'm supposed to be their teacher, right? And so again, I start teaching. A little bit, not a lot at first, it starts to grow. Then we're up to 40 or 50 people coming. And so it starts to grow, but you got to sort of stay at it. And to do it, you know, in an effective way. But again, these are the kinds of things, you know, that I find. Another thing we found, are you familiar with this concept of theology on tap? Basically, back in the States, the idea is that young people like to go to bars, so let's go to where they are. Let's go to the bars, and let's do Catholic teaching. So we call it theology on tap. And what we basically do is we go to the local bar. We send out the word to all the young adults. Come to the three provinces of Ireland bar on DuPont Circle and listen to Father Pope speak on X, you know. Okay. So that's called theology on tap. And we usually get 200-300 young people, you know, for those. What you do is you go down here to Charlotte or whatever the town is down here, and you take out a bar for the evening, and you send out the word. Now, that's just a thought, but it's a regional thing. It isn't just something one parish does. We do it in a region. So our city parishes do one region, and we have some in Upper Montgomery County that do a theology on tap, and then on the Virginia side. Now, the thing I like about theology on tap is that you meet people where they are. And you try to teach, and people are actually very responsive, and it works very well. But on top of that, there's another approach. The only thing I don't like theology on tap is that we set the agenda. Father Pope will come and speak today on chastity and dating, or something like that, you know. And that's the topic. Okay. But there's another thing that we do now. It's called grill the pastor, or grill the priest. Grill the priest. Now, the thing is that with this, you got to be, not every priest is able to do this, because not every priest is able to answer questions sort of on the spot. Now, I'm pretty good at it because I write a Sunday Visitor, I write their question and answer column for them in the Sunday Visitor newspaper, it's a national paper, and I also write for Catholic Answers magazine, so I'm used to getting questions and making quick responses. Did you hear that word, quick? My column is only 600 words, but the idea is that they get to set the agenda. Father Pope will be there, whoever the priest, but just my own name. Father Pope will be here at such and so a time, at the so and so bar and grill, and we usually rent a smaller room in one of these large restaurants, you know, they often have these breakout rooms, you know, like for wedding receptions and things. So we'll go maybe on a Friday night or usually another night of the week. A lot of the young people like to keep their Fridays and Saturdays open for other stuff. So maybe on a Thursday evening, we'll go to the local, one of the restaurants in downtown D.C. We'll use that room. We'll pile in. We'll have some hors d'oeuvres and some drinks. And it's called Grill the Priest. And what happens is then I just sit up there and I might give an introductory, here's who I am, and here's a few things on my mind, but basically I'm cut off at 5 minutes and the floor is open for any question you want to ask. I'll answer anything unless it's personal. You know, like, is it boxers or briefs, Father? You don't want to answer questions like that. But you any question about the faith and so on, and if I don't know the answer, I just say, I can't answer that. Catholic.com, you know, go to the Catholic Answers website, Catholic.com. But rarely do I have nothing to say in an answer. Now, again, we're just getting started with that, so I don't got a lot of feedback. Usually for an event like that, we know we have to seed the audience a little bit. Now, what I mean by that is not everybody comes with questions right away that they're ready to formulate. So we usually have two or three people in the audience who have a question that we've already loaded, so to speak. If nobody asks anything, or if we come to a moment where no hands go up, you raise and you ask this question. You know, that's, so you have to seed the audience, not in a manipulative way, but just in case people don't immediately have a question they want to ask. They're kind of waiting for someone else to ask. You need to kind of break the ice. And so that's one thing we discovered. But the point is, I have found that they ask an amazing range of questions. You always think they're going to ask about sex or why women can't be priests. That's not always the first thing they ask, you know? And some of the questions they ask are very spiritual and very poignant questions. But anyway, the idea is, I'm here and I want to teach you, but I want to know what you want to learn. I'm here to answer your questions. And that's the idea of being out. So it's called Grill the Priest. And maybe here, once again, in this or over in the St. Croix or whatever, you could maybe just have like a restaurant every now and again, once or twice a year. You just get together and you try to send out the word and say, come and grill the priest. You know, just a thought. I'm not saying you should do it. I'm just saying these are some of the things that we've tried. We're trying to get out of maintenance and do a little missionary. And it isn't just something that we're doing at the parish level, but we do it at the deanery level or the citywide level. And we do it in different parts of our diocese. You see the idea? And so we get the diocese to help us. We get some resources and communications that are going, and all the pastors come together and try to support and send their young people, as well as get their young people to bring friends who don't normally come to church, and that's how it works.
Not so much here, but down the island, so that thing is true. They have these crusades on the corner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah, super, super. Amen. So again, those are the things that I was just going to maybe just a couple quick things just to tell you what we're doing, and then, you know, to get maybe more back feedback from you. I would say that there's a lot of good materials out there. I did mention Catholic.com. I do a lot of work. I'm on the radio a lot with Catholic Answers. They have a radio apostolate, but Catholic Answers is the, I don't know how they got the domain, but their domain is Catholic.com. And if anyone who wants to know, have a question answered about the faith, and you don't know it right away or you don't have time to explain it, Catholic.com. It's hard to forget. Just say, you know, I don't have time to answer that right now, but I tell you what, I know where you can find it. Go to Catholic.com. See, sometimes if you're out and they'll ask you an arcane question about something, or you're really in a rush and you don't have time, but you, Catholic.com, okay? That's a wonderful reference. Now, I also use that in our door-to-door campaign. Because we, every now and again, you know, I could only train my door-to-door people so well. They can't know some of the arcane questions that might occasionally come up. Rarely, but, you know, someone will ask, well, what about Pope Gregory the VI and what he said? You don't know anything about Pope Gregory the VI or what he said. And even when they tell you what he said, you still don't know. So, Catholic.com. I don't have the answer to that, but here's where you can find it, you know. So we're always trying to get people resources, you see. Now then, let's just say, well, I don't know. Yeah.
Also,
yeah, well, Google, yeah. Sure.
What is the Tower of Wikipedia?
Yeah, and sometimes the Wikipedia and others, you know, you never know what you're going to find. That's why I say Catholic.com is a little safer if you wanted to get the real Catholic answer,
but
yeah. Yeah, yeah. And most people know to Google, but I think that if you want to give them a church answer, but you can't for some reason because you don't know or you don't have the time, one way is Catholic.com. But again, yeah, obviously Google, yes. All right. Now, the other thing would be we have a lot of catechetical moments that we don't use. You know, my brothers, you know, funerals, we talked about that the other day, right? A lot of those moments where, you know, we've got people who never come to church, but they are for the funeral. Or have you ever thought to have your gift shop open or to have some, you know, this is one of those times where maybe they'd like to browse through if you have one of these. We have a little bookstore in my parish. Why not open it for funerals? Why not, you know, why not have, maybe that would be a time for you to stand back there and greet a few people as they come in. And so on, before the funeral begins. But you see what I'm saying? It's a catechetical moment. The same is true, obviously, with weddings. This is a time where we meet a lot of people we don't normally meet, and it might be a chance for you to have not just ushers there, but ushers who are trained to do a little more than just get people to their seat, but who could, you know, welcome them, ask them if they have any questions, maybe supply them with a quick greeting card from the parish that tells them a little bit about the parish or the Catholic faith. Tell them a little bit about Jesus or whatever. You know, you know how weddings are. People are sitting there forever waiting for the bride. You might as well give them something decent to read. See what I'm saying? These are what we call those catechetical moments.
In our culture, it's a funeral. Mm-hmm. We don't have wakes like you do. But everyone comes the hour before.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect time.
Yeah, perfect time. Yeah. Actually, it's become that in Washington now. We do the same. Yeah. An hour before. Yeah.
And it's really the best time.
It's a great chance to meet people, yeah. And like I say, you don't have to do it all, fathers. I mean, train some good lay people who are kind of type A personalities. We're going to go meet people. We can hand them a little card, welcome them. Give them something, you know, to remember. And, you know, something like that. And we're just now developing it in my parish because we have like 60 funerals a year. I mean, that's like one a week we have. It's just awful. I mean, we have so many funerals. So, again, and so many people who just are unchurched. So, again, I don't know about you, but I've come to the point now where I prepare every couple personally because we just don't have that many weddings. I mean, when I was a young priest 25 years ago, I had 30 weddings a year. Now, five. And that's true about almost every priest in Washington. There's a couple of large parishes that still have more than that, but almost every parish, even the larger suburban parishes, weddings have plumped. People are not getting married. They're shacking up, they're doing every other thing, but they're not getting married. And so I have so few couples now that when they come, I personally teach, I give them each, you know, 6 weeks of instructions. And I say, we meet once a month. I don't meet with them six straight, but you get the idea. But I sit down, I meet with them, I get to know them, I preach, I teach, I open up the scriptures, I exhort them, I warn them. Most of them are fornicating or shacking up and they're hearing from me, but I'm doing it, you know, in a friendly way, but a firm way. And, you know, it's a fascinating thing. I've had a number of couples say, you know what, Father? We heard you, and we stopped. We moved to separate bedrooms. I just had one bride call me just 2 days before I came out here. She said, Father, I want you to know something. You have to change my address because I moved back with my mom after what you said. You know, it works. I mean, not always, but it does, you know. And it's a great thing, and that's a witness, and that's a testimony, see. And so evangelical moments, you know, like these baptisms, you know, gosh. Okay, and a final thought, and then I'm going to just open the floor. You know, I was in a very dangerous neighborhood that's not so dangerous anymore, but I just started leaving the church door open. I have a beautiful church, and it's all the saints. We have 35 different saints painted up on the Clare story, and, you know, the other statues, and then we have, you know, it's just a beautiful church. And people come in and like, wow. And so we have some material for them and have the church door sitting open during the day when the weather's not too cold. And it's unlocked, though, all day. I unlock it at 8 in the morning to late in the evening. I put the word out in the neighborhood, come for a quiet place of prayer and a quiet, beautiful place to pray. And again, not a lot of traffic yet. We've only been doing it for like 3 months. But little by little, the word's getting out, and people are coming through the doors. They're kneeling down. They're praying. They're spending time. They're getting to know the parish. We have literature and material. Once again, it's just our way of saying to our neighbors, this is your church. This is yours. And is for you to come and pray, and we hope you'll be with us at Mass. And just ways of walking the neighborhood, being part of our people's lives, doing missionary, not just maintenance, but doing the outreach, getting to know our neighbors, saying we care about you, we're part of it. And trying our best in different ways to say all these people in our boundaries belong to us, and we need to make sure they've heard of Jesus and have met him. And that's our job. And that's the kind of stuff we do. So, again, I'm just thinking, brothers, that witnesses don't just stand in the courtroom and witness. They go out and they witness, you know, the martyrs, so to speak. So the idea for us, I think, as priests is, again, what do you have? See? So, Father, I mean, because we're in your parish, Father, you have a beautiful church down there. You have the doors open. You have Jesus, of course. And people are coming. You have good people who are there to pray. They're signed up. You said some stay all afternoon, some stay all morning. So you got people. The doors are open. Who knows? Maybe some of the loud drunks that were across there yesterday will maybe even wander in. And who knows? The Lord's rays might reach them. You just don't know, right? So, but, I mean, what a wonderful, you know, having the door sitting wide open like that is a wonderful moment, you see. And I think, for all of you, I haven't been to all your churches, but again, just the idea to say, what loaves do you have? And that's what we need to do as priests, to say, hey, here are some of the things we've done and tried, and here's some good things we can try, some new things. And again, I'm standing up here like I'm Mr. Know-It-All. You've already shown me, you're already doing a lot of these things. So again, I'm mainly doing this by way of encouragement, but maybe also if there's a few new ideas, give it a try. One of the untapped area, and it's just a thought, I'm a visitor, so what do I know? But what about those cruise ships that unload and load? Now, I'm thinking at two levels, pardon me, because part of it's about money. But you have some very wealthy people that get off those boats daily, and they come into the neighborhoods down there, and they buy their little silverware and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, many of them have chaplains on board, but not all ships. But what would be the possibility of having a chapel somewhere down there near Steve O'Leave's place there? They've got all these little warehouse places, or maybe even at certain timely moments when you know ships are unloading, it would be, you know, you have to send word to the cruise ships, but that Mass would be available. And then you can connect them with this diocese a bit and say, here's some of our needs here. You know, these are wealthy people who go on these cruises. They've got some change they're willing to part with, and, you know, make connections with them. And again, mainly, of course, what you want to do is get them, make sure they know the Lord. This is your opportunity to say, have you met Jesus? You come to St. Thomas. Hello? What do you know about St. Thomas? You know, not just the island, but I mean the saint, you know. And we're here, and we're God's church here, and we care about you, and this is our way of greeting you. At least come and pray in our little chapel, or perhaps you'll know at certain points when there's a cruise ship. And my parents did a lot of cruising, and they would never go on a cruise if they didn't know there was going to be a Catholic chaplain on board. So they always, I forget what the one of those lines always has a Catholic priest on board, but not all of them do. And so, but I do know a lot of Catholics who don't have a chaplain on board would be happy to know that there'd be Mass available when they disembarked, and it would be a brief Mass, and it'd be your way of welcoming them, giving them a brief moment with Jesus, and sending them off to buy silver. but again, just a thought. Now, there may be any number of reasons, legally and things, that maybe you're already doing something like this. But it occurs to me, I was there down there with Steve O'Leave. He picked me up from the airport, and we dropped by just to say hello to his son, Tim. And there was a woman who was getting back on the boat with her husband, and the taxi driver, you know, those big open-air taxis. The poor woman was just drunk out of her mind, and the husband was not, he wasn't in great shape himself. And God bless the taxi driver. He cared about these two. They were staggering in the traffic. And he pulled them back, and he helped them across, and he got them over to the boat, you know, to the entrance where the stewards could take care of them. But I'm going to tell you, I mean, there's a woman who's in trouble. See? You know, because they're on a cruise ship doesn't mean they're all together, obviously. That poor woman was drunk out of her mind. And my poor mother was an alcoholic, you know. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's just a thought, just as a visitor. So please just take it for what it is, just kind of a pipe dream more than anything else. But gosh, think of the thousands and thousands of people. And maybe even if 1% of them say, you know, I think I had a great experience in St. Thomas, and that diocese says they have needs, they have poor people. Here's a donation. Anyway, just an idea. Yes, Father, come on, see you.
1990s, I had an opportunity to work as a part-time cruise ship chaplain.
Yeah.
Celebrity. That took me to Anchorage.
Anchorage, oh yeah, way up there.
One of our stops in Anchorage, because I went there twice, we were taking straight to a Christian center,
mm-hmm.
but it was not a Catholic
center. Yeah, right.
And these people were so nice, so good.
Yeah.
They provided a bus to us,
mm-hmm.
and we went there, they took us to the center, and then back to the ship.
Yeah.
And when I came back, I said to myself, we have some opportunity in St. Thomas.
Yeah.
And then from that moment on, I set up a small group of people to kind of study and look into ways of
doing something similar.
Creating some sort of excursion.
Yeah.
You know, because when people go on a cruise, they select their excursion already.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I realized that we were not part of that yet.
Yeah.
Sometimes. I did what I could have done at the time to make sure that we are somewhat distant,
right.
but we were not successful. However, I trained my high school at the time, seniors, to really come and make presentation and give tour guide in the church and so forth. And they did that, and they were very good, the seniors at the time.
Yeah. Right, right.
And their parents were very excited to see that their daughter would come and speak about the church and turn around with no paper.
Right.
And given the history of the cathedral, the paintings, and
sure,
so forth.
Sure.
But then they graduated and left.
Yeah.
So it's a work that we have to do.
You can return to it,
I have been training my she's very good at all, you know, guide and so forth. What we have. We have, that project is there. It's done, but we're waiting for the cathedral to be...
They can tour the cathedral, right. Yeah, tour the cathedral. Now, you might get in trouble with the silver merchants like St. Paul did, right? hey, we want them to come to our silver store. You're taking them to the church. But remember, you're being good company with St. Paul who got in trouble with the silver merchants in Ephesus, right? Any rate. Yeah. Right. Sure. Yeah. All that, yeah. Yeah, no, it's hard, yeah. Well, anyway, just a thought. I realize there's a lot of obstacles, but it'd be wonderful, and you connect people to the Lord, but you also connect them to the diocese, and maybe you're to work with the poor. Some ideas, you know, making connections with people throughout the whole world. I mean, how many people from all over the world come through the port over there every day? And that's your chance to bring them to Jesus and Jesus to them and then connect them maybe with your work. And it's just a thought. But that's dreaming big, right? It's dreaming big. Even just standing out there with your collar on, you know, the low tech, right? Free prayer. Hold up a sign that says free prayer. We go into in my parish, we have a big, what they call Eastern Market. And so every now and again, I take some parishioners. We go out and we hold up a sign that says free prayer. People, you're praying for you now. Let's pray for you. You start praying. Before you know it, we got a little line. People just want to be prayed with. It's amazing. You're Catholics? Yeah, we're Catholics. Anything else, fathers? I mean, just some other ideas or things. I know you're trying and you're doing a lot of great things. So it's just a question of if you want to share anything that some of the rest of you might not know about.
Witnessing to the people out there as Catholic, what I've seen following the March for Life in Washington is that the group of the group set up by Father Eduardo, they kind of come out and show signs, as you were saying, so forth. But I feel that this is a good thing to do. But somehow, it has to be, because I see this as just one group thing, while in fact it could have been expanded so that the involvement of other pastors, you know, are there, rather than just waking up one morning and seeing something on the corner of the street.
Yeah.
So this brings to mind a question that I have from day one. Yes, the witnessing. We could do that individually, but we could do that as the whole presbyterage.
Right. Yeah.
So are there some suggestions that it could give us from your experience as the presbyterate witnessing together?
Right.
Because that will help us a great deal, because the numbers are dwindling. The numbers are going down. It's affecting all of us. But we could come up with a strategy that will help all of us, you know, witness and witness powerfully. Do we have some ideas that you could?
I know in D.C., because we're a larger diocese, we break into deaneries. And the dean, I'm a dean of the Northeast Department. I have 12 parishes I'm supposed to unite. And we do some regional work. I also am the dean of, with 12 other parishes, in a separate kind of a ethnic deanery we call the African American. We call it the Mission in Motion Project. And so I and two other priests, the three of us kind of are the leaders of it, but all 12 pastors come together. And so right now we're doing a men's Bible study, because a lot of men in the black community have been left behind. Our parishes are very dominated by women. And so we're trying to reach back to the men, and we're trying to get them to, you know, and we want to do more effective ministry. So we started that part. We've also got a youth retreat that we're doing with all 12 parishes. Because when the parishes get smaller, the problem is that you might have 3 or 4 kids in this parish and 12 or 15 in that one, but you don't have synergy. You've got maybe, when you got 40 kids, now you've got some synergy, you got a lot of energy and interest, and kids are meeting other kids, and all of a sudden you can get a good retreat master to come in for 40 or 50 kids, and you're not trying to duplicate efforts in each parish. So we do a confirmation retreat for all 12 parishes. We just start banding together, and we do a lot of regional work, because we just have to now to be effective, because we've gotten small. And so again, part of that, I think, is, you know, we start to lose the human resources, that what they call synergy, you know, where 12 people in a room aren't just 12 people in a room. They're 12 times, you know, to the squared, because they all bring individual, you know, and it starts to grow. So you begin to do a lot more regional works. I don't know, do you have like a setup where you have regular meetings with the clergy or like the deanery, or how does it work? Because I know you're on 3 different islands. That doesn't help. Yeah, all the parishes on St. Croix get together and work with the youth on one combined thing. And I remember when I was at your place, the idea at least was we did an adult mission, but we also did a youth one. I went to the school one day, but we also brought kids from all over the parish. And, well, there must have been 150 kids there. It was a lot of kids. Yeah, right. Good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so those are the kinds of things, you know, you just have to be really intentional about, and somebody has to kind of take the leadership, of course, and sort of agitate and animate and promote it. But among your number, you know, you can at least decide on different islands together, hey, we really got to get all the kids here on St. Thomas together. It might be a harder thing to get all the kids from St. Croix with that. What is it, $250 to go back and forth? It's like, no! Ouch! But, yeah, okay. But anyway, but the idea would at least be to get the two closer islands. And, you know, you know these things. It's just a question of somebody taking the leadership and saying, by God, we're going to do it. And we're going to grow it. And it's going to take 4 or 5 years of repeatedly doing it for it to really begin to take on its own life, you know. But it'll happen. It'll happen because it starts to generate its own energy after a while. But you have to really be willing to stick at it for a few years for things to be successful. So, like, by the way, on Saturday, just before I came here, we started out with only like a dozen men at the Bible study. And last Saturday, I had 75 men there, you know? And it's great. I mean, we went through the story of Jonah, and they were just with me all the way. And then, you know, I had to move on, but they have their own leaders now, and they take up, and they're developing some projects. They're trying to reach the younger men now. bring. They said every one of us has now the task to reach two men who are 20 to 25 years of age and begin. You know, that's a lost generation. You gotta, those men in their 20s, bring them in, bring them in. And so they're all, each one of them, trying to go and connect with two men of that age group and bring them in. And so that's kind of the way these things work. But we've been doing that now. We've been planning that and working with it for like 3 years. And we've gone from, like I said, having 12 people to having 75 men at the last one. Another example, by the way, when we walk door to door in my parish, one of the things we found out from the young adults is that our parish masses are too long and the timing is poor. And so they asked for a shorter mass and perhaps an evening mass. So I started a Sunday evening mass at 7 p.m. And I started out with 5 or 6 people, and now I'm up to 70. And they're all young adults. They're all new faces. No one are the usual suspects. So I've got 75 new faces just by adding a mass. And I sent out flyers. We did all that. We did the door-to-door, sent out the flyers, put out mailings. But you see the idea. I mean, you listen to what people say they want, need, and if you can reasonably do it, and it's not just, you know, I want cheese and crackers at every mass. I mean, that's just dumb. But if it's something of substance and we can do it, we did it. So, yeah, it is the express mass. In fact, even with me at the helm, we're done in 40 minutes, start to finish. Yeah. I promised them. They said, and I advertised it, this will be a brief mass of the quiet evening hour. Because they said, love your church, beautiful choir, it's just too long and it's a little too loud. And so I advertised it. This will be a brief mass of the quiet evening hour. And that's our way of saying, we hear you. And the word gets out. So, thanks be to God, because the other sectors of my parish are still continuing to shrink. So at least with the 75 new faces, it doesn't look... I've eroded in some of the other areas, but you don't notice it because they've got 75 new people coming. And by the way, we started a young adult Bible study based on that now. And again, all new faces. And I started out with just 2 or 3, and now we got about, 10 or 15 of them coming routinely on Monday nights for a young adult Bible study. And so it starts small, and then it grows. But you stay at it. So... Fathers, thank you for your patience. I mean, I'm a motor mouth, and you know what the biggest problem of all is? There's not a clock on the wall. I have no idea what time it is. So when there's a clock, I can usually gauge it. But thank you for your patience, and I realize that I'm not trying to say I've got all these ideas. You've got them. And like you said, you're already doing some of these street campaigns and different things. And I think the question is just for all of us to go back to what the Lord said finally to us and simply finished today on this topic. What do you have? What bread? What do you have to feed them with? See? And just start there, because we're overwhelmed. We're not going to be able to do everything. We can't reach everyone. Our head will explode. But what do we have? Well, we do have some people. We can begin to gather them. We can get help. We have the Lord, of course. We have Eucharistic adoration. We can open up. We have our churches. We can open our doors. We do have meeting spaces. We can meet our neighbors. We can, little by little, we can just start changing our clubhouse mentality to a more missionary mentality, encourage our people and begin to get them to help us with it. And they'll resist it first, but like anything, you just stay at it and eventually it gets better. So I think we got a long way to go, and I think the church is going to shrink before we get bigger again. But you know, what's the, and I'll be beginning with this a little bit tomorrow at Mass with you, but the idea is, look, there's just one rule. Really, at the end of the day, sow the seed. Some of it will fall on rocky soil. Some of it's going to fall on good soil. Some of it's going to fall among the thorns, but some of it will fall on rich soil. And it's none of our business, really. At the end of the day, we do our best to prepare the ground, okay. We do our best to cultivate around it. But at the end of the day, we sow the seed, and we have to leave a lot of it up to God. You know, what does St. Paul say? I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. But we do have to sow the seed. That is our task. We sow the seed. And not everyone will listen. Some of you will give us the middle finger, you know.